text that we're studying, which is by Shantideva, everybody thought he was totally lazy because they never saw him. He never participated, he never came to class, he was never in the debate. He was always in his room, or sometimes they saw him going to the toilet, and he came to eat. So he was called, he got the nickname, the three-activity monk. Eating, sleeping, going to the toilet. He didn't mind. He just continued with his business. And so one day, the nuns kind of thought, let's really embarrass him. Let's show him how he is and how lazy he is. And blah, blah, blah. So to make fun of him, because we're sure he doesn't know anything, he never goes to class. So we will ask him to teach something. So they went, you know, the right way. They went with very respectfully to ask him for a teaching, like women do sometimes, you know. And maybe also men, I don't know. But I know that women do it, this I know, because I've done it myself. So they went and he very respectfully asked him for a teacher, Venerable Monk, Bhikshu, could you please? And he said, yeah, okay. Would you like something, a text that already exists, or do you want me to teach something for me? And they thought, oh, from him, because what's that going to be? Oh, yeah, a text from you. So he said, all right. And so so they thought, let's really embarrass him. And then they built quite a high throne without any stairs. So you know, how is he going to get up there? And he came, and all of a sudden, boom, he was sitting on the throne. This is why I said I'd love to be Shantideva. And then he started teaching this text by heart, in verse form. And people were going like, you know. And then when it comes to the ninth chapter, which is all about emptiness, where he refutes kind of all views, and then all of a sudden he started to disappear. He was not there anymore, but some could still hear his voice. Some who had the karma to hear his voice, he would still hear his voice. He disappeared. And then people, because such a beautiful text, they were looking for him, but they couldn't find him anywhere until they heard that he was in South India. So they invited him back, but he didn't want to come. And then it's in South India that he wrote his second text, which is called Shiksha Samuchaya, which is about behavior for a bodhisattva, but like with more instructions, less poetic, but more instructions how to behave. So he only did these two texts, which are still today very much studied and practiced, and are found like very helpful to study and to practice. So I wish I was him, but I'm not. Everybody is okay, like more or less. It's not lasting much longer. It's only today until, like tomorrow until about 4 o'clock something, you know. So then you can go out and do whatever you want again. Then you'll be free, you know. It's funny how, you know, we come here sometimes because it's too much, the world out there and all this, and then we can't wait to go back to the world, isn't it? Or sometimes also, I didn't mention it today in the patience meditation, it's good to see how we spend a lot of time in meditation just waiting for the meditation to finish, and then we forget, we actually decided to meditate, and I'm just sitting here waiting for the meditation to finish. Whoa, what am I doing, you know? And it's especially in a Vipassana retreat that you notice how, you know, there's a break, so you wait for the gong to go, because you're not allowed to read, not allowed to talk. It's really strict, no eye contact, you know, you have to bring the senses in, don't let them out, la la la. So it's absolutely really no entertainment, you're not even allowed to smile at people, and so you don't know what to do. So in the break, you wait for the gong to go so you can go back in the session. The session, you wait for the gong to go so you can go back out. This is, you know, and the moment you catch it, then your mind is much more focused. This is the thing. You have to see it, and it's not enough for me to tell you. You have to feel it. You have to catch yourself. You have to experience it. Tonight when I came into the dining room, because I came from behind, my mind, where's the soup? No soup! You know, I'm like, only salad! I was so good! And it's a little bit later, I saw the soup, and I'm like, ooh! So it's okay, I saw it, you know? That's what I mean. I mean, I saw it before seeing the soup, that what the mind is doing. There was going, it's salad, it's bread, it's trina, it's, what's it called, halva. So it's okay, you won't die of hunger tonight, you know. And then I saw the soup. But the first thought, because I came from behind, I didn't come from there, I was like, no soup. How do I talk about other people without making bad speech? That's a good question, that's nice. For example, discussing with a friend about a problem he has with someone consulting and so on. What should I take into consideration? Is it necessarily gossip? No, because of course, you know, if we want to help somebody, and it's okay to help others. It's all right if you think we can, you know. It's okay to discuss it. There's Mother Teresa who says, anybody knows what she said? I mean, she said many things, but about speech. Before you speak, check. Is it necessary? Is it kind? And is it true? Oh, we would be silent most of the time. So, you see, it's okay if you do it for the benefit of the friend and the person that you are discussing. I think to see that it's not gossip is if you talk about somebody with somebody else, because you need two people, and then you involve somebody else in your talk. And then you find out that the person was next door and the door is open and they heard everything you said. If you're not embarrassed and feel kind of, ooh, I should not have said that, it's not gossip. But if you feel embarrassed and you are really not happy that the other person heard it, then it's gossip. Do you see how you can judge, you know, whether it's gossip or not? Because usually we discuss the negative sides of somebody else with a person. It doesn't help. I mean, the one who has to know it should be the person itself, but that also sometimes not so beneficial to say, because they hurt and they become defensive and they start to argue and, you know, they don't necessarily want to hear about their negative sides. Okay? So not every talking about somebody else is gossip or is negative, but very often it is. Because it seems to create some kind of pleasure. You know, wow, have you heard what happened to that or what he did, or, you know. Two questions I have. A question regarding jealousy. Thanks. You said that someone shouldn't be jealous of others receiving something because he wouldn't have received it anyway. What is the rational or cause or recommendation for not being jealous? In case that I'm jealous of someone getting an attention or help and I could have received. Had he not received it? Well, you still don't have it, you know. I mean, does the jealousy help you to get the thing? So I hope I get this clear. That means I have 100 shekel and I don't want them, and, you know, maybe it's about inheritance, I don't know. But I give to Noah, but actually Shoshana thought I should give to her because she needs it more, and she sees I give it to Noah, and then she comes and says, hey, but I need it more. Is that what this means here or something? Well, how do you know that you should have received it? What makes you so sure that it was due to you? You know, inheritance is like, it's my money. It's not your money, it was your parents' money. So what makes you so sure that it's mine? Just because the law says so? But that is only thinking if there is a problem in the family and somebody gets it all and you don't get anything or you don't get enough and this and that. Don't let it spoil your life by hating your siblings or your family or whatever, you know. It's not your money. You didn't earn it. It's the parents' money, and then they decide to give it to you or to... What was that? Okay. To you, or I thought it was like a bulb exploding or something. They give it, you know, they decide to give it to you or choose an organization, for example. How about your parents decide, maybe better I don't give that young person too much money because it can be not helpful at all. I know young kids who receive a lot of money who never had to work in their life. It's not necessarily beneficial. They not always use it for the right reasons to further their education or whatever. They don't know what to do with their lives because no need to grow up, no need to do anything, and at 30 there still is mommy who's paying. It's not necessarily a very compassionate thing, you know. Of course, as a parent, you want to make the lives of your children easy, but yeah. This is why I told you the story of my mom, you know. With 8,000 Swiss francs, we were four people. Actually, there would have been three, but I included my sister-in-law also because I say, why not you? Just because the law says so? You know, why should I get half and the two nieces the other half? Let's divide it into four. There's four of us who are close. So I don't know what I would have done if it would have been a million, you know. I hope I would have also divided into four. Afterwards, when I thought about this, then I thought, yes, I would. But on the spot like this, you know, it was very easy to make 2,000, 2,000. It's not that much money, okay? It's about 2,000 times four is like 8,000 shekel. It's not the end of the world, is it? And so I hope I would have been as generous if it would have been a million. But not sure. This is the funny thing, you know, that when we have a lot, it's much more difficult to share than when it's little. It was so stupid, you know. They made in the Spiegel a few years ago, there was a thing, it's all about jealousy, yeah, here, that I should have received. They made a thing about with kids, you know, kind of, you get five candies, but this kid gets seven. If you don't like that, none of you gets anything. So the kids, until they're 3 years old, they don't care that the other one gets seven and him only five. They take the five and that's it, they're happy. From 3 years old, they start to think. And the older they get, they prefer not to get any, so that this one, especially if they dislike the person, don't get anything either. Of course, that's not you. You wouldn't be stupid as that. You would take your share and you would think, okay, the other got more, but doesn't matter. At least I got 50,000. And they went up to these levels of 50,000 euros, 50 and 70,000 euros. It's almost unbelievable, but it could happen to us also. I hope not, because now we are prepared. So if somebody comes with an offer like this, you say, I take it. So yeah, so, you know, you haven't received it. So what's the point of feeling jealous? Then your jealousy is always that thing that you're not happy with what you have. And you forget what you have. So what's the point? You're poisoning your life, yeah? I tend to ask myself this question when my mother is helping my sisters with the kids, and also ask myself what to tell my kids when they are jealous at one another, when they receive something. Oh, are you? You know? A friend of mine, she's got three children. So when they are grown up, she asked them, which one of you has the feeling that the others got more and you didn't get enough? All three said me. You know? I know there are mothers who prefer maybe one child to the other. It happens. It's very painful. It's true, but, you know, it's the mother's choice. It's not fair. Maybe your sister needs more help than you do. Maybe it's easier to help your sister. You know, if you want somebody to help you, make it easy for them to help you. Don't make it difficult by being demanding and wanting more and this and that. Make it as easy as possible. And we can see that this happens in old people's homes sometimes, when the people don't want to be there and they're very bitter and they want to be independent and they don't want to be helped. They make it very, very difficult for the staff. Do we have somebody who is working with old people? Is it like that? Yeah. So already now, when you're young and you see this, you put imprints on your mind, subtle mind, when I am old, I'll make it easy for people to help me. And when you hear yourself now when somebody wants to help you and you go, no, it's okay. Train now to say, oh yes, please, that's very kind of you, thank you very much. Then you will be able to receive the help that the nurses actually are quite ready to give you. It's just that these people don't allow it. Then you're a happier person because you will be liked. You know, and you know, if you're a bitter person, the nurse doesn't want to spend time with you. They do their job and that's it. They go because you're constantly complaining. So let's become happy old people and let the nurses help us. And if we see the nurse helping somebody else, I have a friend who's working in a hospice with dying people. So she had a CEO dying, like a chief executive officer, very rich person, and a homeless person next to him in the room. And he couldn't get it that this person was getting as much attention as him. He couldn't understand. A homeless person. A drug addict on top of it. And me, the CEO. I should get more attention. It's a very nice hospice, by the way. Poof. I would like to go and die there. Is that okay here with the jealousy thing, or do you want to ask more? What do you tell your children? Tell them how it makes them feel. Make an awareness meditation in a playful way with them, you know. What did I do with kids at one point also? They were selling their stuff. They were about 5-6 years old, 3 or 4 of them. They were selling their stuff. And with the few pennies that they got, they bought chocolates and, you know, sweets. So they came home with this thing that was on the table. And I said, wow, great, you know. And mommy was cooking. So I said, are you going to give some to mommy? And she went like, no. So I started saying, oh wow, it's great, you know, mommy is cooking. I really love it when somebody cooks for me, and then sometimes also somebody washes my clothes. This is really great. I'm so happy that I don't have to do it. And you know all what the mothers do, I tell them that how happy I am when somebody does it for me so I don't have to do it. She got it and she took 2 sweets and she went to her mom and she gave her 2 sweets. If you do it in a playful way without forcing them to do it, let them discover it themselves that it would be good to give. Not, hey, you're selfish and you're bad because your mother is doing all this for you, you know? And also with this thing, doing something for others. I was with a child who is, he's spoiled rotten. He's 28 years old and he is about to get married and I'm invited to the wedding in Portugal. So anyway, so he's a very beautiful kid and he's very charming, but he used it to really, already as a very small kid and very spoiled. So the brother was in the hospital, the mother asked me to look after him for that day because they went to his, and I went like, oh no. So I thought, okay, to have an easy day, I just let him do whatever he wants to do. As long as it's not harming, it's okay. So we wanted to go for a bike ride, so we went, and he can't ride a bike. He didn't listen to me how to do so that it would be safer. And so then I took him off the bike and said, look, I've been riding bikes for 50 years and you just begun, so you listen to me, otherwise you go home. I was quite firm, so he was a bit frightened. And he doesn't eat breakfast. He hates it. So do I. So I allowed him not to eat breakfast, because what am I going to force him if I know that I don't want breakfast either? So I said, okay, today no breakfast, but nothing before lunch. He said, oh yeah, great, happy. You know, these kids, when you make these deals with them, at the beginning they're very enthusiastic, but then when they have to pay their part, then they're not so happy anymore. So anyway, 11 o'clock, I'm cooking. I asked him what he wants to eat, so I cooked what he wanted, spaghetti, of course, and chicken or something. And then, so he comes and he says, I'm hungry. And I said, I don't care. We'll eat in 1 hour. It's okay. You know, you won't die of hunger. Then he goes back to his room. He comes, but I'm really hungry. I said, you know, I live in India. I know how hungry children look, not like you. So he went back to his room again. And then he's a kid who never eats apples or vegetables. So he comes and he says, And I was still in that health thing, you know, like only raw food and only fruits and vegetables. And I ate like this in that house. I was living with them. So he comes and says, can I have an apple? And I said, yes, this you can have. Because now you used your head and not your nye, 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 nye. Because he knew the only thing I get from her is probably an apple. And it made him eat an apple. So let go of your principles, you know. Honor the intelligence of a child. And then, you know, so we continued afternoon TV, playing games, TV, playing games, this and this and this. And then I cooked dinner and I needed something from the shop who was just downstairs. And I asked him to go and get it and he said no. And I got, you know. And I felt like saying, hey, the whole day I did for you what you wanted to do. I'm asking you. And I thought, no, I'm not going to say that. It's not helpful because that's what he hears when his mother gets upset because he's so selfish. So I said, okay, I go myself. And he was grumpy. He was really grumpy in front of the TV. So I came back. I said, hey, Samuel, how do you feel? Are you happy? Because he was on holiday and, you know, and we did all day. And he said, so I said, look, we did everything you wanted to do today. What do you think could we have done more? And he said, I don't know. So then I said, how about you change the whole thing around? How about you try something as a six-year-old kid and you do something for others? Just try it, you know. Next day, when the mother was cooking, he said, can I lay the table? And the mother looked at me, she said, what did you do to him? So I explained. I said, I think he felt that I was really concerned about his happiness. That I didn't want him, make him to do something for others because he's my child. And it's nicer if the child is kind and nice and polite and all this. I think he really felt that I was concerned about his happiness. And I didn't care if he would do it or not, you know. I just gave him solution. Well, he's still kind of spoiled. And now it's his wife who's spoiling him. But I really like him. He's really nice. And at the beginning, when he started to like grow up, and it's my ex-boyfriend's wife and children. Okay, this is why we have such a good connection. So at the beginning, he would be kind of the older one, very attached to me. The other one, somewhere, because he knew I could be quite strict, and he always kept away. But from that day on, he really started to really like me, and then the other one got jealous. And you know, these two boys I talked about not being able to win, to lose, it's these two brothers, yeah. And now the older one, he's got his burnout, he's got a problem, so yeah. And he did ask me, can I do something with meditation? So it's very nice. Both of them trust me very much. They come and tell me their problems, and I only go there once every 2 years or something, you know. Very nice relationship I have with these two boys. So I told him to do MBSR, not Buddhism, not meditation. If you have a burnout, don't go to a meditation group. That's what I told him. Because you see everybody else sitting there and having a good time. And you are sitting there not knowing what to do. Mind-based stress reduction, it's called MBSR. You know, and you don't know what to do and your mind is all over the place and everybody knows what they're doing, it's going to make you feel worse. So MBSR is especially when you are stressed, burnout, whatever, and they have like group talks about this, meditations that are tailored for that, like mild meditations and things like that. Huh?
What's burnout?
Burnout is a Hebrew? You know, when you have a lot of responsibility and you work very hard and you're not allowed to say, look, sorry, I cannot do this anymore, and you keep going until you get anxiety, panic attacks, you get sick and you get depressed. And your joy is out of the window. And what is really strong in burnout is panic attacks, having a feeling that you're totally incapable of doing anything, but still faking that you can go on, and anxiety most of the time, and depression. These are the signs of burnout. Mind-based stress reduction. It's a thing that has been started by Jon Kabat-Zinn in America, and it's all over the world. They have a very good system. They train people that make small groups, like all, you know, pockets like this all around Switzerland. We have at least 20, 30 or 50 of these gurus. Oh, you can find in your neighborhood, you can, there's no problem, you can find. You can see the need of it, huh?
There is in
there's a few in the country.
I'm sure there are. So if you feel that would be something for you, it's a really good system. And he wrote to me to thank me that to send. First he said, yeah, but I have school that evening and this and that. So then I said, you need to know what is more important, your school to know more for what you already know is a very responsible job, or your mental health. And he chose the mental health. And he's very happy that he started. He said, it's doing me so much good. So like that. So with the kids and the jealousy, just... play, you know, use these methods that you learn with the children, not one-to-one. It's too much for them. They don't understand in a playful way, right? Like also a mother an Indian mother is doing a Tushita course. And then at the end, when Ling Rinpoche was still quite small, now he's, 22, 23? But he was living next door to Tushita in Chopra House. So he would come over for the picnic. The picnic, I think, is still happening last day, isn't it? At Tushita course. So, pizza, Coca-Cola, chips, fruit salad, chocolate cake, that's it. Since 25 years. At the end of every course. Pizza and chips. So he would come over for the picnic and then people could ask him questions. You know, you're 6, 7, 8 years old. And so a mother said, oh, this is so valuable, blah, blah, you know, how can I teach my child? And she thought probably asking a child, he would not. So he looked at her and said, but you, do you really understand what this is all about? And she said, well, not really. Then he said, how are you going to teach your child if you don't understand? You know, he was maybe 7 or 8. We talked about jealousy again, okay, and how to behave about with another person, but I'm not sure how to recognize one. I feel while receiving that from a close friend or loved one, it makes criticism or something, can't read, to me. I find it hard to recognize, oh, is he or she jealous? There. For not sure how to respond, how to recognize what I'm hearing, seeing. Well, as long as we can't read people's minds, it's a bit difficult to know whether it's just a helpful criticism, like, well, how you call this? Constructive criticism. That we always invite people to give us constructive criticism, but we don't really want to have it, whether it's constructive or not, you know. So like that. So, to be honest, I don't really know what to say. Just be kind, be open, hear what the person has to say. And even if they say it out of jealousy, if it's true, then make amendments. If it's not true, why get upset? You know, if they criticize. This is usually what they do. And this is usually the thing that you get about criticism. If it's true what the person says, why get upset? Do something about this. If it's not true, why get upset, you know? If somebody tells me I have a big nose, it's true, I have a big nose, you know? Why should I get upset, even if they say it with anger? I have a big nose. If somebody says I have horns, why get upset? I don't have horns. If somebody says you've put on weight, yes, it's true, I have put on weight, you know? It's okay, I know it, you don't have to tell me. Actually, you don't have to tell anybody. Everybody knows when they put on weight. I don't know why we always think we have to tell people. They know. Studying the text, we talked about praise distracting us from samsara thinking. No, it's not distracting us from samsara thinking. It makes us think samsara. It takes us away from spiritual work, that's true. Also about people who chose not to do any spiritual work yet, happy with their life. Why not? Yeah, exactly. Why not? Nothing wrong. We should have more happy people on this planet. Even if it's worldly happiness, doesn't matter. Because also worldly happiness makes you relaxed for a while. Okay? So don't go, if somebody's really happy and they don't do any spiritual practice, don't go like, oh, yeah, yeah, but you know, it's not going to last. Eh? This is like, it will end, and then also you will want more. Don't give them that Dharma knowledge. Be happy when they're happy, because when they're happy, they don't harm you. You know, it's okay. Something wrong? No, not nothing wrong. Will they not deal with hardships of life when it comes by without spiritual? Yes, that's true. But don't tell them that while they're happy. You know, when these people, this happiness, this worldly happiness, okay, is very fragile. Because if somebody tells you why, I'm so happy, you ask why. They say, I have a good relationship, can end any moment. I have a good job, can end any moment. I have financial security, can end any moment. I have a lot of friends, can end any moment. And that's all the sources of happiness that they have. And the thing is, so we have these pillars that we think, you know, health, friends, job, money, house, or more things, doesn't matter. We think, okay, there's five or six of these things. If one of them collapses, I'll still have the other four. But the thing is, they don't hold. If one collapses, it doesn't hold. If you know that you have cancer, it doesn't help you that you have $1 million in the bank. If your wife just left you, it doesn't help you that you're healthy. You know, if you can't pay the bills, it doesn't help you to have a lot of friends unless they give you the money to pay the bills. You know, and you know, I can talk about burnout because I had one. And I shouldn't have said anything. I think I wrote an email to TechChock about something, and I said, I feel quite, I have anxiety attacks and panic. And he, of course, as a good Israeli, immediately action. So I got advice what to do. I was invited to Israel. You can come here, and very kind. We pay for your ticket. This is how the group, the Dharma Friends, are. You know, they really look after their teachers. It's amazing. Like, I think next day I had all these invitations to come to Israel. And, but all I wanted to do is stay home and be quiet because I knew I could deal with it also, and it didn't last very long. I knew I had to be quiet. But what I noticed is that it doesn't help when everybody, I still had the panic attacks. It doesn't help when everybody invites you to their home. It doesn't help that I can pay my bills if I have, or somebody else will help me to pay them. It doesn't help that I was living in a nice center, in a nice house. The panic attacks were still there. It's true that if I would have been destitute, no friends, it might have been worse. That's true. But all these other pillars, they didn't hold. You know, the Dalai Lama always says, don't go on a mission. You're not a missionary. And if he says it, I think we should listen. You know? When ordinary people are happy, they're not interested in practicing. So let them enjoy that happiness. Of course, you're 100% right. That would be the moment to practice. So let's apply that to us, to see how much wish we have when everything goes well to go and sit and meditate, leave our friends, we have a very good discussion, how much wish we have to leave them and go and sit. How much?
What I did, I'm very lucky.
Yeah, I know, you're an exception, you're not the right person to have discussion with. Yeah, it's true, you're right. So, but you know, it's, of course, to tell them the truth when they say that, yes, I'm happy, and you ask why, then you could tell them all these things.
No, it's, say it's terrible and it collapse.
Say what?
Why not come to
court? And then they say, what for? I'm happy. You know, my schoolmates. I went to quite a good school, but I left when I was 15. That was the quickest that I could leave. You had to stay there until you were 15, then I left. I didn't like school at all. Now, they, of course, because it was such a good school, they're all like, you know, some are in the government, not quite high up, but like counselor there, like how to say, in Senate. And some are lawyers, some doctors. So then sometimes I go to school reunion. So then they look at me, you know, go like, okay. So, and they say, you know, it's very nice what you're doing, because kind of it doesn't harm anybody. But, you know, I don't need to do these things. I'm happy. Then I say, well, if you're happy, I'm happy for you. It's great. I'm always happy when people are happy. That's all I say. What shall I say? But they do come when they have problems. And then they ask. And it's true, it would be better to start while the problem is not there yet. So if you are here and you don't have any problems, be very happy, because it's the right moment to start practicing. Because then you have the tools that I had during my burnout. So after 2 months, I was totally okay. Not even 2 months, 3 weeks. I said, totally okay. Really, you know, and I had to work very hard because it was during the visit of His Holiness. But while I had the burnout, the mind was kind of as if I'm organizing the whole thing alone. This feeling, how am I going to do that? You know, I was a volunteer who put up chairs and tables. And I had volunteered for that, and I was looking after the shop that we had, or helping with that. But the mind goes into, I'm organizing the whole thing, me by myself alone. You know? And even reasoning, saying, hey, come on, you know, they will give you, you're just an ordinary volunteer. You're not in, but they wanted me in the committee, and I said, no, I don't have time. And also, I don't have the capacity. I don't have big view. I can do details, but I cannot big overview. I panic. So I said, I'm not suited. Don't volunteer for a job that you're really not suited. Even though it would give you high status, a private audience with the Dalai Lama, and all this. There's no point, you know. So then I could see, you know, a burned out mind is grasping at problems. The moment you solve one, it's already looking for the next one. Have you ever noticed that? Yeah. And so I was kind of watching what the mind was doing. So I had this ability to come out of it, but the mind was still doing it, okay? You see, being aware of what the mind is doing, it doesn't mean that the mind will stop immediately, yeah? But I was not sucked into it, okay? And the fears that I had is how to pass the day, because I couldn't do anything. Nothing made sense. Nothing was pleasant. Nothing was interesting. So that's the biggest fear I had. And then I started doing something for somebody else. For a project, I was roasting sesame seeds. I made gomasio, you know, for about 3 weeks. And I was occupied, and it was beneficial. And people were happy that I did it because nobody had the time to do it. So I roasted 50 kilos of sesame seeds and made 500 of these 100-gram packets. Some helped, but most of it I didn't. Then we sold them at Teachings of His Holiness for a project in Nepal for nuns. In Tsum Valley. This is it, you know. Do something that you know doing when you have a burnout. Something that you don't feel insecure that, oh, I can't do it. And then just do it. And if it's for somebody else, it's much better than painting therapy or whatever, you know. Something that needs to be done, something that you see it decreases, and the thing that you've done it increases, it smells good, gomasio, it's healthy, you know. It's the perfect therapy for free. Okay, so when they're happy. Yeah, it's true. So this is for you now. You're here, you're young, keep practicing even though you don't have any problems. Because all these tools will be of great help when the problem comes. Because trying to develop the tool when the problem is already there is very difficult. This is why for me it's quite easy to give advice to somebody I know they're practicing. But for somebody who doesn't have any Buddhist practice and they come with their problems, I don't know what to tell them. Because I would have to give them the whole of the Buddha Dharma for them to understand. Yeah. It makes me wonder about the balance between rejoicing and truly giving it space in my life, where my awareness about samsara is the balance, lies with the understanding impermanence, practicing non-attachment, and so on. I hope I understand this right. I met a young woman in Belgium who had been practicing for about 2 years. And then with the group, we went out and we had a set menu, and ice cream was included. Now, I don't really like ice cream, but it was included, so I ate it. She looked at me and she said, why are you eating this ice cream? It's suffering. You know, everything is the nature of suffering. I said, no, sorry, this is ice cream. This is not suffering, you know. So then if you This is the danger of understanding the Dharma intellectually, and then you lose the taste for life, because you think everything is bad, and you don't allow. And you then, I don't know how it is with Judaism, but you take the Christian thing inside your spiritual practice. If it's fun, it can't be spiritual practice. Or let's say, if it's joy, it cannot be spiritual practice. It has to feel bad for it to be successful or have some benefit or whatever. How is Judaism in that aspect?
It's okay to enjoy.
Huh?
It's okay to, it's good to enjoy.
It's good to enjoy. Okay, yeah, then you have one advantage, at least, over the Christians. No, I thought that it's not possible that they all agree on that. Yeah, anyway, so you know, Calvinism, like the Protestants where I come from, and it's like whatever has joy is bad, sin or something like that. Rigid, very rigid. So don't take that into Buddhism. You can enjoy something knowing that the joy is not coming from the ice cream, but the joy is coming from maybe the thought, may all beings have such a nice circle where they eat together. Good thing that this person who made the ice cream, I'm eating it now, that they can sell it, otherwise they would have to throw it away. You know? Good thing that it's so expensive, so then they earn a lot of money, that also, for example, you know? These kind of things. You can use it to really explore, is the pleasure coming from the ice cream? Or is the pleasure in my mind thinking that ice cream is good? So then you start to take one spoon and you say, wow, good. And you start to see the thing more, okay? Then you take the next spoon and it's still more. And then the third, still more. And then most probably your mind is already in the conversation with the next person and you finish the ice cream, you don't know what you ate. But if you're in silence and if you continue to eat, you see that the more decreases. And all of a sudden it goes enough. And then don't stop. Continue. Yeah, right. Continue. And then the more changes into, ah! And you see, and then you go, this is still the same ice cream. How can it change so much? This Lama Zopa Rinpoche did, at one point, he did that to us. He invited us for the buffet in the Hyatt, in Delhi, you know, we never go to the Hyatt, and you know, in India we used chapati, rice, dal, vegetables, finished, you know, or thukpa in the evening. So there is this Western Indian Asian style buffet of everything, cold, hot, breakfast, dinner, lunch, everything there, and the desserts was a wall like half of this long, half of this room. So we ate, okay? We were very happy, and we ate, and we ate, and we ate. And then upstairs was a bakery. And he said, we're going to go to the cemetery to make offerings to the spirits. So please, some of you go and buy some cakes. We went to that bakery. We couldn't even look at the cakes. We were so sick. That's the skill of a teacher, to show you something, you know. First, he spends a lot of money to invite us so that we totally binge on that whole thing, because we hadn't had these things for at least 5 years, you know. Whipped cream, you know, never get whipped cream anywhere in India, but there they had. The Hyatt had whipped cream, and I love whipped cream. So it's like, and then I had to go, we had to go and buy these cakes, and he was like, whoa. You know, Indian cakes, like colors and cream and blah, and you know. So yeah, so then this, you can use your samsara for that, to really see. It looks good, but it's not good. And another example of samsara that's very good, I think it's from Rabchang Rinpoche. He taught in Bogaya, and he said, you know, samsara is this rebirth again and again and again and again, cycle of rebirth without control, okay? So he says, samsara is like an Indian thali, okay? In Indian thali. A thali is a plate where you have many different dishes. So, you know, you're hungry and the thali comes and you go like, wow! And then you need to wash your hands because, you know, very often in Indian restaurants, in the real Indian restaurants, they eat with their hands. So you want to go and wash your hands. So you pass the kitchen. And you've seen kitchens in India. There's a dirty curtain, you know, where they wipe their hands. And, and the curtain is usually torn and totally black and full of fat and oil and whatever. So you look in the kitchen. So there is this guy sitting on the table holding the carrot with his toes, which they can do, you know, and chopping it. The other one is, you know, stirring in the palak paneer, and his sweat is dripping in the palak paneer. Then you see the cockroaches running all over the place, you know. And then you come back to your thali and you go like, it looks good, but if I eat it, it will create a lot of problems. That is understanding samsara. It looks good, but if I totally consume it and do only that, it will create a problem. Yes? Okay, so the balance between enjoying life and having renunciation. When pleasures come, by all means, please do take them. You know, I mean, for the Dharma practitioners, why do you have pleasant feelings? What's the cause for pleasant feelings? The ice cream? No. Okay, what? Yeah, positive imprints on the mind ripening. That's it, that's it. It's not the ice cream. This is why with the same ice cream, it can change. Yeah? So if you want to have pleasant moments in samsara also, then you need positive karma. But if you're using it to have pleasures, then you're exhausting it. But if you have a pleasant whatever dish or doesn't matter what, think like this. May all beings enjoy that. You know, then you create more merit, so it's not exhausting itself. You can train; it's totally possible. May all beings enjoy good food. May all beings, and then the shopkeeper is happy, and blah. You know, you try to see how many people you're helping by consuming that, and then dedicating. Also, you think the person who has made this dish, I dedicate my practice to this person, so that they can attain enlightenment really quickly. Then it becomes a Dharma practice. You see the emptiness of the whole thing. You see the impermanence. You see, seeing impermanence does not spoil your pleasure at all. We just think it does. But we enjoy much more when we know it's not going to last. Everybody enjoys a rainbow. There's no attachment to a rainbow because you know you can't own it. But it's not like, wah! Yeah? It's just, wow, an open feeling. You see, actually with the rainbow, you see emptiness. When the causes and the conditions are there, it will be a rainbow. When the causes and conditions finish, the rainbow goes. What do you need? A dark sky, the sun, and humidity. And you have a rainbow. There's nothing mystical about it, you know. There's also the Tibetans say, what are you going on about these rainbows? If there is a rainbow in the blue sky and then it doesn't rain, then you can go, wow. That's usually when high lamas are being cremated. Then you can go, wow. If it's like normal conditions, there's no big deal. Yeah, so like this. So you, I don't know who asked the question, but you can balance it constantly by thinking about impermanence, and then you see how much effort you want to put into getting out of samsara and how much effort you want to put into finding pleasures. You know, the foundation of all good qualities, when in one of the verses, it doesn't say samsaric pleasure is suffering. It says seeking samsaric pleasure is the door to all suffering, because they are uncertain and cannot be relied upon. That's the verse there. Not having them. Having them is okay. You can enjoy without any attachment, knowing it's impermanent, but for the moment it's good, it's great, and that's it. You know, knowing that the pleasant feeling is not coming from the object, although if it appears like this, but it's coming from the mind. Okay? What is freeze? Well, you know, this freeze, flight, fight, this comes from our reptile brain, and this is our reaction to a dangerous situation. So freeze is like the rabbit, the snake and the rabbit freezes, you know. So for example, for a human being, you shut up, you don't communicate, but you also don't show anger, you just freeze. You know, like, I mean, the mind goes like that. And then the problem with these emotions is like we lose contact to the cortex where the common sense is sitting. That's the problem. Shame, guilt also makes you lose contact to the cortex. So that's why it's not so good. Is that is okay with the freeze? And you know, I mean, it's like it's just how we react. There's nothing good, bad, or and it's not the Buddha who says that. It's science. So this is not from the Buddha. This is from science, but we can use it. How do you deal with your best friend, which disconnected from you? Yeah, that's painful, isn't it? The uncertainty of samsara. At any moment, this is what I said, at any moment we can lose anything. Everything we attach to, everything we love, is like friends, possessions, money, status, your mind, your interest in Dharma practice, your life. You can go crazy, just like that. That's why we want to get out of samsara. Not to make samsara a better place. That's what you want to do, most of you. You want to make samsara a better place. The Buddhists want to get out of it. But samsara is not a place, it's a mind state. Nirvana is a mind state, samsara is a mind state. You can be in Israel and be in nirvana if you have realized emptiness and you meditated on it for a long time. Yeah? Yeah, so it's like, you know, how do you make them come back, especially when they kind of, you know, spread rumor about you or have heard something about you or what, or you hear something about them. It's like, leave them alone, I would say. I don't know. If they hate you, if they don't dislike you, you know, as I said, you can love somebody from the distance. If you want contact because you want to be loved back, this is attachment. This is not love. And then if the person needs something and they call you, then give it. That is love, you know? Love is, I will be there for you whenever you need me. If for the moment you don't want to have contact, that's fine. Because it's not going to help, it just creates more problems. It's very painful. This is probably, you know, it's the thing that hurts the most. People that we trusted, and then, you know, they do these things, or they gossip about us, and maybe destroy the relationship that we have with other people because they spread these rumors or truth or whatever it is. But really, with the wish to separate us from common friends, sometimes also that happens. You know, that then they go to the circle of friends that we have and they influence them so much that we feel the aversion when we come into the group. That's very painful. Nobody says it's not. Feel the pain and then go, I will never do that because this is really painful. But also know this is ripening of your karma. From the Buddhist point of view. If you don't believe in karma and rebirth, then I don't know what kind of use you can give yourself to make you feel better. You know, it's always this thing, you know, hope for the best and be prepared for the worst. We're always hoping for, you know, we always think everybody should do what we want them to do. I'm loyal, they should be loyal. That's not the game of samsara. That's not the rules of samsara. That's not what is happening in samsara. You know, not even in Buddhist circles, not even in sanghas, you can trust that we will always be friends. That's illusion. So when you look at the sufferings of samsara, you remember the six: uncertainty, like you can lose anybody, and it's painful because we would like to have things certain. Whatever I like should last. But it lasts as long as your karma for that lasts. As long as your bank account is full, it will last. When it's empty, that's it. But you can fill it again. Yeah. Uncertainty, dissatisfactoriness. If you are born again and again and again as a third, because birth is also suffering, you will die again and again and again and again. No matter how high you are, you will always fall down. No matter how famous you are, you know, as you get older, you lose your fame, you lose your capacity, you lose your skills. The people that suffer the most when they're old is these people that had a so-called full life. Famous, rich, able, lots of skills, very intelligent. These suffer the most. The people who were nobodies, you know, they're quite okay when they're old. It's quite amazing. So the thing that we work and struggle for so much is creating so much quadrium, is creating so much suffering, old age and at the time of death. What else do we have? And we are the sixth one. We're totally alone in that process. Nobody can take away the pain from you from when such a situation occurs, when one of your friends really betrays you in such a bad way. Nobody. You will have to endure it yourself. We are born alone. We have to die alone. It's quite something. Whatever I see the world is my mind. Nobody else can share. I cannot share my world with anybody else because it's only my mind experiencing it. I cannot go out of my mind and experience the world outside of my mind. It's impossible. It's the only thing I have is my mind. And the purer it is, the better it will look. The more angry and jealous and pride, the more horrible the world will look, and it's full of enemies. The Tushita Jeep, I don't know if it still has the sticker. No anger, no enemy. Doesn't mean that nobody, I saw you, doesn't mean that nobody harms you, but you don't wish to harm somebody else. So if you have that mind, at all costs, I don't want to harm anybody. Oh man, be happy and content with that. And don't expect others to have it as well. But if you have it, it's something so beautiful. So be very happy if you have that. This wish, there's no wish to harm others. No wish for misfortune of other people who have harmed or hurt you. That is so beautiful and so precious. So just be happy that you have that. And, well, again, let's turn the whole thing around. If you really have nobody in your life that you dislike, okay, then you're a very lucky person. But if you have one person that you dislike, you know how this friend of yours feels now who dislikes you. Do you see what I mean? You cannot will to like people. Whatever is ripening in karma or here, there, everywhere, this is what is happening, you know. Okay, then the last question and then we finish.
Do you remember the six sufferings of samsara?
Yeah, you don't have six?
No, I have two. Uncertainty, dissatisfaction.
Uncertainty, dissatisfaction. Then, you know, when we are born again and again and again and again, meaning being born, that's the third, we have to die again and again and again and again. That's the fourth. You're born, you have to die. You know, I mean, you don't want to die, don't be born. This is like... and then this, no matter how high we get, we always have to come down again. That's the fifth. And we're quite alone in that process. People can try to help us. But when you have deep grief of having lost somebody, then you feel that loneliness. Nobody can take that pain away from you. And nobody really understands what you are going through. So basically the Buddha's saying is, we... all collections end up running out, every meeting ends in every living, blah, blah, blah. Kind of, we build things up together, like we build things for them to fall apart, because that's what they do. If we don't keep it up, if you leave things alone, if you leave a house alone, it will fall apart. So we build houses for them to fall apart. We meet people to separate, because we will have to separate, either already in this life or at the time of death, and we live to die. So the thing is, every collection ends up running out. Sorry, all the high will fall. Every meeting ends in separation, no matter how long it lasts. It will end. Every living ends in death. That's samsara. So if we are okay with this, then stay in samsara. But we don't like these facts. We don't like them. And we try to go against them. This is like, you know, trying to make a river flow uphill. So for the moment, with all the pumps and all this, maybe it works. But the moment you stop the pump, it comes all the way down again.
So,
loud, eh? Because I'm old and don't hear well. No, when you realize, the first step is to realize emptiness directly. Then you have to deepen that realization, and then you are not reborn and again, because what makes us reborn is this grasping at existence. That's the cause to be reborn. That's in the 12 links, okay?
And the second question is, what's the difference between samsara and bardo?
The bardo is part of samsara. Yeah, there's different traditions. The Nyingma tradition talks about, I don't remember exactly because I never studied it, 4 or 5 samsara. You know? Okay, great. It's the bardo of living, the bardo of dreaming, the bardo of bardo, the intermediate state, and the bardo of dying, or what?
Between,
huh?
There's one between rebirth. To
yeah, this is the normal one, but there's more bardos. Because you see, we're always in between. Like in the morning, we are between night and noon. At noon we are in between morning and afternoon. We're always somewhere in a bardo. Bardo means in between, from rebirth to rebirth, like that state where the mind has not found a body yet, and that they say it lasts at the most 49 days at the most, but it can be shorter. Okay Good. You need a pee-pee break before the meditation, or shall we go into the meditation? Huh?
Too cold,
okay. Does everybody agree? Okay. We could also have, you know, this is what we, I can't remember where we do that. Like the people who are in general too hot, they go that side. And the